Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very latest episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about board games, and the people who love board games. My name is Tom Brewster, and I'm joined by Matthew Lees.
Hello, 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 hello.
And last week on the podcast, Matt, it was just me making it a one-player podcast. This time on the podcast, there's the two of us making it a two-player podcast where we're going to talk about two-player games.
Yes. I've put a 50 pence P in the machine and I've pressed the button and it's gone, a new player, a new player, a new player. But actually, it's not four players. It's just I've kept putting pound coins in the machine and pressed all the buttons on the arcade machine. And we're going to lose now because two of the people aren't even being controlled.
I was thinking that what we could do is we could just slowly expand the podcast into a two-player, then a three-player, then a four-player, then a five-player, then a six-player podcast, covering only games that fit those player counts. And I'm trying to think when the wheels would really start to fall off. Maybe there's three or four seven-player games out there. Maybe there's five or six eight-player games out there. But I think when we get into 9 and 10 and 11, that's when things are going to go really crazy.
What, with nine people on the podcast as well?
Nine people on the podcast and finding the games. It's telling that my immediate worry was finding the kinds of games that would have nine players playable.
Yeah, I think at that point, as soon as you get like 8+, as soon as you get like, oh, this is a game for 10 people, really what you're talking about at that point is sports. And that's, you know, that's fine, because I think that you get a certain mass of humans that the requirement is to even house 10 people within a space, you're already getting to something that is the size of a ping pong table that's just made out of people.
Once you get to a certain number of people, they will naturally do sports, is sort of what you're saying.
Well, I just think if you have enough people, then the distance between the people, it means if there's going to be any meaningful interaction between people who are far away, that's going to mean either A, people moving their bodies around, or B, people throwing things to each other. So there's a dexterity element to any massive gathering of humans. And that's my review of the world.
On this podcast, we're going to talk about three two-player games. We're going to start things off by talking about Tag Team, a Street Fighter-esque game of bapping people in teams. We're going to talk about Suna Valo, a game about making a farm competitively to another farmer who lives just across the river from you, and you're really annoyed by them. And then we're going to talk about General Orders Sengoku Jidai, a game about doing war on a tiny little board. First up on this podcast, we're going to talk about Tag Team. This is a game designed by Grisha German and Corentin Labrit, with art by Nyad, published by Scorpion Mask. And this is a game of biffing each other in the face with fighters. Yeah. Fighting style.
Yeah. It's 2v2, which is very confusing because it's a 1v1 game. But you both get to control two separate fighters that stand next to each other. And you guessed it, are going to be tag teaming back and forth, going, you punch them this time, and then going, maybe I'll punch them again, but then it's your turn to punch them. And both of you are going to be punching each other at the same time, because this is a simultaneous auto-battler deck builder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to be building these little tiny decks of cards that are going to sort of autonomously fight against each other. The thing that's interesting about this game is like the first round of it isn't really a round at all. It tells you, please, shuffle your deck. And your deck at this point is two cards.
Well, no, you don't shuffle your deck, actually. You never shuffle your deck. You choose the order.
Oh, yeah.
And then you never shuffle it for the whole game. So the spicy thing about this is the fact that, you get these cards. You, at the start, you just have one card for each of these two characters. And then the order you choose to put them in becomes your deck. Mm-hmm. And then you both put your decks on the table. And one at a time, you just flip over your cards and you just act out the things that card tells you to do. Usually, it's like, I'm trying to hit you or I'm trying to block. But each of the characters, and especially these two beginning cards, have kind of special spicy rules usually. All of the different characters do things in odd ways. And often these special cards that you start with are the ones that are kind of juicing the engine. But we'll get back to that. The main thing is that at the end of each round, which is just when you've gone through this deck of cards and got to the bottom of it, you're going to draw three off the top of your deck, which is made up of a 50-50 shuffled split of the cards that are for those two characters that you're playing with. So basically, you've got this one draw deck that's both characters, and then you draw three cards, you choose one of them to add somewhere to your auto battle deck. But just like in a game like Scout or whatever, that is a fixed order, which means you can slide a new card in anywhere you want, but that's it. Once you have that in position, you can't move anything around for the rest of the game. in any way other than adding new cards to shuffle along the specific order of what things are happening. And then the game itself is kind of like rock, paper, scissory in a way, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you're sort of just slightly nudging your cards like one place forward or back, and then you're sort of seeing your engine run against your opponent, and broadly all you're going to be doing is hitting each other. When you take a hit, the character whose card was last played is going to receive the damage from the hit as it comes at them. But you can also play block cards. You can have block cards in your deck that will block hits. And when they come up, that means that no fighting is happening. You're blocking all of that damage, and maybe you're going to get like some kind of counter style effect. So there's like a lot of them where if you successfully manage to block an attack, you will do some damage back, or you will gain some power, or you'll trigger up some other kind of special ability.
Yeah, the cards are all spicy, right? It's like you hit someone, and if you do hit them, then you get this bonus. And then so really at the start of the game, when you've just drafted a few new cards into your little like auto battle deck, it's that thing of really being like, okay, we've got five or six cards in there, let's say, and you know that last round you got hit twice in the face right at the start, so that means next time you might draft a block and put it on the top of your deck, meaning you know that you're going to block that first one.
Yeah,
unless the opponent works out you're going to do that and then puts another new card on the top of their deck so that the first block you do doesn't block anything and then they hit you twice again. So really, it's a game of like almost like a memory game, but not really, because you can remember the order of like roughly what happened last time in terms of when they tried to hit me, I tried to hit them, they did their special power up, and then I did this. But all the only control you have is by shuffling along the sequence of what you plan to do by one card at one position in the deck. It's kind of a weird one where like trying to get your head around it at first, you're like, oh, this is really complicated. But actually, that's all you're doing is you're just moving the sequence along by one space. But it's where you choose to do that. Do you do it later in the deck? At the start of the deck? Do you maintain the sequence and just put something on the end of it?
Yeah.
And at that point, it becomes this really cool little, like, gentle battle of the wits combined with a slight memory of people being like, have I put this in the right place? Is this the time where I should put the block in?
And all the characters have these very bizarre effects to them. So the ones that it recommends you start with are quite straightforward across the board of all of these weird characters in Tag Team. You start with a man who turns into a bear, where he has these cards that increase his rage. And when he gets to a certain threshold, he becomes a bear, becomes very strong, very tanky. You've got a character that starts with a fleet of ships at her disposal. And the effects that she has access to gently change based on how many ships she has. But then I think the interaction that made both me and you kind of like sit up in our chairs a bit in our first game is that there's a character who's special, or one of his special cards allows you to permanently remove a card from the other player's deck. And so if you concede it in the right place, you can really knock out a tentpole of their strategy. So that ship lady we just talked about, she has this one card that's like, cash in your ships, do your big effect, because based on all the ships you've been accumulating. And this other guy just nudge that card out of the deck completely, out of nowhere.
It ruined me. I mean, and this game is so fast. This is a game that you sit, you grab a couple of characters, you shuffle the decks together. They're only little decks of cards. Mm-hmm. And then you just go, and you can finish a game in like 15 minutes if you're being nippy. So really, having that level of like malleability and destructiveness within the gameplay, the fact that you just destroyed my character's engine, you know, because the thing about that character's ships thing is funny, is the fact you build up these fleets, and everything you're doing with these little cards is adding more ships to your fleet. But actually, you don't want it to be like really high. Like when it hits 20 and that card comes up, you do a big whap of damage and then it goes back to zero and you build it up again. But actually, in between that, what the ships do varies, and it means you've got these sweet spots. Like, it's pretty good having ships up to about 7, and it's okay between like 7 and 15. But then after that, it's diminishing returns. So by removing that, it meant that like my ships were just stuck at 20 and I couldn't do anything with them, and I had no passive effects anymore from my fleet. I just imagine somebody on a boat somewhere being like, we're waiting for a message from the commander to fire the cannon. And it's like, the commander's not on the ship anymore. They're gone. And there's all sorts of funky, like little like interactions with these characters.
Yeah, and I really like how all of these different characters kind of almost act as a bit of a tutorial for the sort of nuances of the strategy in the game. Like, one of my favorite characters is a guy called Shango, and his whole ability is to set people on fire. If he hits the same character over and over and over again, he builds up heat on them, and if they ever get 5 heat, then they instantly lose. Just immediately they're gone. And that doesn't matter how much health they have, it's just if you get those 5 markers on them. The trouble is, if you hit any other character, you get rid of all the fire on the original character and put it on this new one. So you have to build it up from scratch every time you switch targets. And the reason that I think that is super interesting is, I mean, not only is it kind of a fun mechanic to juggle within the game, but it also gives you a real awareness of the way that the game handles damage, because you only ever do damage to the character who is being flipped at this current present moment. So if you're trying to win the game in a really clean way, you're trying to really target exactly one character, which means you need to pay attention to where things are in the deck and focus all your efforts. And then you realize how that follows into the fact that you don't want to just have your deck stacked with just one character, because as much as you're giving them loads of moves and building up their power, you're also exposing them to all the negative effects that your opponent might have. So there is nuance there. There's not so much that it gets overwhelming, though, because as you say, it's like 15-minute games. They're really short, sharp bursts.
And I think that, like, it is interesting in the fact that, like, there's a really nice skill space, like skill, like, variance.
A skill floor and a skill ceiling and skill walls to make a nice little skill cottage.
Yeah, a lovely bit of skill architecture. Now, there are some characters that are just very easy and chill to play. Like, and, you know, I think, is it called M'lady? I think there's like it's basically a cool lady with a fencing sword, and their ability is they just flip over these tiles. You build up tiles and then you flip them over, and so when you flip them over, though, what they do, you don't know what it's going to do, and they're all pretty good, but the fact that you don't know what they're going to do means you're a bit like YOLO. But it doesn't matter. It means you don't have to think so much when you're playing, and you're still probably going to do pretty well because it takes some of the thinking out of the way, and in exchange for that loss of control gives you power. Mm-hmm. On the other end of it, you have got characters like Django where it's like, you know, there's a lot of finesse to it, and if you're not actually thinking, then you're probably not going to get much out of that character. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in between, and what I really liked about it is there's a whole bunch of characters in the box. Is it like 10, 12?
Yeah, there's just a bunch.
There's what feels like, in the base game, enough for a delightful small box two-player game. And within that, they all do odd things. They all kind of break the game in different ways. And I started to realize when I played it a bunch that whilst it wasn't a game where there was like tremendous, like there was enough depth to get your teeth into, but once you played all the characters, it felt like a real fighting game in the fact that there were like clear counters. There were clearly like this character has an incredible power that does this. And that's when, like, it's one of the first games where usually when I'm playing a board game and it's like you draft the things at the start, I'm like, I'm not sure I can be bothered, you know? let's just jump in. Let's just either randomize it or use some suggestion decks. But in this, I feel like once you've played it a bunch, drafting is kind of essential, because it means you can see a character and you can go, I know what you're going to try and do with that. So this is the counter to that. And that's the point where I thought, Tag Team is not just like pretty cool. It's like, it's really great. It's like, it's neat. It's tight. Because every time you find something that you feel is unbeatable, you then find something else that would beat it.
Yeah, I had this come up in one of my games where there's a character called the Wild Bunch or the Rowdy Bunch or something like that. And their whole gimmick is that there's just five of them. And so any damage to them kills one of the five of them. but obviously, if you do like 20 damage to them, it's kind of wasted because it just gets rid of one character at a time. So picking them means that a character like Mordred, who is this sort of like power creep, get a whole bunch of damage and then defeat your opponent in one blow, which is completely useless against them. And so you might draft that kind of aggressively against Mordred or defensively the other way. It's just very interesting. There's like, and there's enough there, isn't there?
Yeah, the fact that you mentioned earlier the ability that one of the characters, actually a couple of characters, have the ability to remove that card and a card from the other player's deck. When you flip it over, you just go, both cards now, out of the game. One of the characters is just like some fairies, and there's three fairies, and when each one of them dies, they become a spirit, your powers get more powerful. But then you're not actually out of the game when the fairies die. You're out of the game when you flip over their special card that basically then says, oh, if you flip this over and all your fairies are dead, then you immediately lose the game. Mm-hmm. But it means picking that character in response to someone else who's picked those things is terrifying. Because if you manage to make it so that they accidentally remove that card from the game, then that character is invincible. You know, and it means you then have to kill their other character to win the game because you only have to kill one. It's just super pleasing. And I think that like one of my favorite things in two-player games are puzzles that you get to unfold with someone else. You know, that feeling of like you can just open a box and be like, oh, cool, this does this, this does this. It's a great game to play once you know it. But that experience of just spending some time learning it with someone else and seeing all the intricacies firsthand, it's just a joyful way to spend an evening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's like a pretty like low price of entry as well, if I remember correctly. Like both in terms of the time it takes to play and the actual cost. Yeah, I really quite like Tag Team. I think we'll come back to it.
I think it's fabulous. It's great.
Next up on this podcast, I wanted to tell you, Matt, about Sunavalo. Sunavalo? Sunavalo? I don't know what how to say the name of this.
Sunny D?
That's the one! This is a game designed by Andreas Odendahl with art by Lucas Siegman and published by Capstone. It is a 1-2 player game of building up a farm and trying to beat your opponent into the ground with it. Yeah. One of those kinds
Wicked.
Of games.
So it's basically a lot like the game we just talked about.
Yeah, but for farming, but for agriculture.
Oh, heck yeah. Grind those seeds down into nothing.
The manual for this game proudly proclaims that it is a standalone two-player game in the Planta Nubo universe. And I just realized now I was meant to run with that. Hey, Matt, have you heard about the hot new game Sunavalo, the latest in the Planta Nubo universe? And try and sort of hurt your brain a bit.
Planta Nubo? Buddy, they won't even let me plant the new bow.
So to briefly explain this game, you are going to be building up a farm in this kind of a solar punk setting. It's sort of like steampunk, but instead of it being grimy and gross, it's all blue skies and everything's nice, and there's wind farms and solar power and all that stuff. There's technology, but it's not bad, is kind of the premise of solar punk, I guess. And what you are trying to do in this game is you're building up your little farm, and you are going to be ultimately trying to get resources, which are going to ship off to fulfill these various orders. If you get some eggs and some seeds, then maybe you can send them for some points. What I've explained so far sounds kind of very by the book, and much of the game is quite by the book. You are going to be on your turn taking these cards from a little shared market and putting them into a tableau. And the more cards you get, the more actions you will get to take. So for example, if you take one of these little green cards, you're going to get some seeds. And then every time you take a green card later on, you will trigger all the other cards in that column. And the same goes for every sort of collection of cards in the game. Get cards that give you resources, and then get more of those cards to re-trigger those bonuses over and over and over again and build a bit of an engine.
Right.
Rather than get into all of the gritty detail, I'm just going to give you some of the little highlights of what I thought was really cool about Sunavalo.
I mean, that's it. Immediately, I feel like this is one of those games where it's pushing you towards like min-maxing. It's pushing you towards just doing one thing really well. But I bet that that's either difficult or leaves you in a pickle for other reasons.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. The mechanic number one that I'm going to talk about is the fact that you have very limited storage for these things. If you look at a picture of the board, maybe I'll put one in the podcast thumbnail as a treat, you'll see that each of the resources or each of the icons you have will often come with like a little bucket symbol below it, which means that you have one little storage space for one little resource, which means that sure, you want to hit the same little bonus over and over and over again and get loads of eggs, but you've only got space for like one egg at the start, or you're just gonna need to invest in more storage. And I
either
like that.
Big egg or small bucket, either way it's a problem for you.
I really like games that actually like properly engage with like inventory mechanics. Game I'm sure we'll come back to at some point, but I played a bunch of Scara Bray. It was a game featured in our Board Games Direct series. You can find that on our YouTube. And that is a game that, yeah, it has this like very restrictive inventory. You're always having to make sure that you're cleaning up after yourself. And this has a similar thing here where you don't want to just, well, you do want to just hit the same bonus over and over again. It's what's going to get you the most stuff. But actually finding a home for it is much more challenging than it initially appears.
I feel like collecting things is just a thing that people love to do in games.
Yeah.
Regardless of why. In the same way that in video games as well, like people like to shoot things and they like to collect things. And
that's why the video game Destiny 2 is as popular as it is.
Well, exactly. And I do enjoy it occasionally when, in board games, we have a kind of push against this kind of collecting instinct by having like stuff like this, of having very limited resource storage space, or having things of like, you know, between rounds, you can only keep so many things. So do as much as you can with it. And there's no point in having a billion bits of iron because at the end of the round, it's all going to go away. Or even on a bigger scale, at the end of the game, you're not really going to get much for it. So don't hoard things.
I love one of those like oppressive end of game rules where it's like, I think this has it, where it's like, oh yeah, like these resources you're gonna spend a while getting. Yeah, it's like they translate into points at like a 7-to-1 ratio or something crazy. It's like as you just tip it all into the point bin. So you're sort of building up these engines to get resources and fulfill these contracts. But here's the thing that I think is really special about this game and the sort of one mechanic that really sets it apart is that broadly throughout the game, you're going to be buying these cards from this sort of shared market and putting them into your tableau, stacking up these actions. But every player has a little market of three action cards that sits above their board, and that player will set their price for that card. And the way they set that price is with their own resources. So I might have to spend, say, like 2 wheat, and I'll put it on a card to set the price of that card as 2 wheat. And if my opponent wants that card, they'll have to pay the cost on it. So they'll have to pay me 2 wheat, and I get the 2 wheat that was on it back for my own purposes later on. Or I could buy the card, which would have me just shuffle the 2 wheat off into the bin, and then I'd take the card and put it into my tableau. And there are minimums on each card. So each one of these cards has to have a certain number of resources. So there's a bit of like fixed value here where certain cards, you know, have to have a certain amount of resources on them. But it wrinkles the game in a couple of really interesting ways. Way number one is the sort of obvious one, which is that you could grab a card that your opponent likely really wants and then set the price quite aggressively for something that you kind of need more of. Or if you definitely don't want them to have it, you could set the price as a resource that they don't have any of at all, essentially locking them out from it unless they do something crazy.
Well, this is I have questions because this is interesting. Does this mechanic mean that the only way you can build things is by putting them in the shop and then buying them?
There's a shared market that both players can buy from. Otherwise, all of the cards sit in your little market. And whenever someone buys one, you replenish it from the market, which can also be used aggressively because, you know, those cubes I'm saying, you put the price on them based on your own resource. You have to basically spend your resources to set the price. If you spot there's a card in the market that's like worth loads, you could buy a card from your opponent and then essentially force them to replenish it with a card that they can't properly afford, which means they have to put these shortage tokens on it, which costs them points. There's some nice, horrible detail in there because it means you have to keep like a float of resources so that you can set prices for things. You can't do that thing where you're constantly scraping the bottom of the barrel. You have to have a bit of like throughfare in your resources as the game goes on. It's really weird.
Sounds weird and mean. Two of my favorite things.
It is weird and mean. But there's a few other nice sort of like details here where the different kinds of deliveries you can make, each will take a sort of different colored piece off of, or sorry, a different shaped piece off of your board. And there's this like very tantalizing point tracker to the side, but in order to advance it efficiently, you need to make lots of different kinds of deliveries. There's also a whole bunch of upgrades that kind of like expand your board in weird and interesting ways. And it just builds into this quite unusual experience. Like, we've had a lot of these games, like something like A Feast for Odin or Agricola or similar, where you are doing a kind of passive agricultural experience opposite your opponent. But Sunavala was interesting because it's much toothier. It's very like directly combative. Like, it's very nasty from the get-go, even though you're still doing this quite like passive income generation puzzle opposite your opponent.
It makes sense in the future when we replace all of the bad energy with wind farm and solar, that we have to find other ways to be horrible and destructive.
Yeah, other ways to exploit each other and our environment.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. We've got to gotta tickle that meanness out of me. I'm going to go and be horrible to my neighbour for no reason.
Finally, Matt, you've been playing General Orders Sengoku Jidai, designed by Trevor Benjamin, David Thompson, with art by Taras Staheli, and published by Osprey Games. I played the first one of these. You're playing the second, the newer, the shinier one of these.
Yeah, I have not played the first one, but I imagine I quite like it because I like this. It's a strikingly tiny little war game for two players, which basically has this set map where you have like, you know, these are the people you put in these positions. You have these different types of units on this side of the map. You're on this side of the map. And then you have a slight bit of randomization in terms of there being these special locations marked on the map that if you hold them, you're going to get little bonuses. And sometimes they're mostly just passive things that make one aspect of the game a little bit juicier. And this game comes with two maps, one of which is kind of a smaller one. The other one has a bit more like space to it and a bit more of a kind of sprawling build out. And they both kind of have different units that are played with. You get more advanced units in the bigger map, kind of some more like siege equipment for breaking into houses, etc.
Yo!
But I'll come back to that in a second. On the basic version, you know, you have the ability to... don't worry, Tom, we'll get to it. Don't worry. There's time for siege. There's always time for siege later. You have your ground units and you have these little boats. And a lot of the game is about just basically moving units around the map, taking control of areas. Very traditional kind of war game little hexes. Move things into this hex, move the boats over here. And then you have different rules for attacking different things in different spaces. So boats can attack people. People can attack boats. People can attack people. Boats can attack boats. It's very, very equal opportunities here for land and water-based violence. However, the dice you get to roll when doing that, it depends on what you're doing. And more crucially than that, not all spaces allow you to do all things. So the funny thing about this game is that in the corners of the different hexagons on the board, you're going to have these little symbols. And a lot of the game is about placing these orders. You get like, you know, six little columns that you're going to pop on of your color to show that you've activated a space. And you might activate a space to move into it. You might activate a space to shoot out of it. You might activate a space to do something else. There's all these different symbols. Not all spaces allow you to do all things. And that gets spicy very quickly because a round is over once you've all placed all your things. And it means going first is super important because if I place one of my little tokens in a hex to do something in it, to move into it, then the other player cannot move into it that round. They may be able to activate a nearby space to attack into it, to kill some people, but they can't move into it because I've already activated that space. So it's about having this interesting decision space where you're partially trying to do the things you want to do quickly, but also trying to shore up your positions to ensure that other people can't do something that they might want to do. And even on the small map, when you have like a couple of little different fronts where you might be trying to do things, in my game, I was trying to sneak some people across the river to go and take some juicy point spaces and a special location that would give me better naval power, whilst also maintaining my hold of this small island nearby, which had a factory, which meant that every time I built ships, I got to build another ship, and I was taking control of the seas, and it was delightful and glorious. And, you know, I think what's really impressive about this is it does manage to create these kind of feelings of a big war game in A, an amount of time that doesn't take very long, and B, a startlingly small amount of space. You know, you this is a tiny board with some tiny components on it. And then you have a deck of cards on the side. These cards can do special things and give you little special one-off powers that you can play.
I was going to ask about the cards. Are they like a sort of... Is it a set of cards that is designed to be somewhat predictable? Or is it a set of cards that's kind of a bit like woof, bang, pow weirdness that you're kind of introducing by getting
them? There's not too much woof, bang, pow weirdness. They're pretty knowable once you've played it, you know, once you've seen them. And interestingly, there's different cards for the two different sides of the board. Like, they're, you know, it's not just one deck of cards because they're quite different battles. And then getting these cards involves you, instead of playing orders on the board, you have this other little menu to the side that you can put them on, which allows you to get more troops, get more boats, or take cards and snag the first player thing, which is a kind of a big deal. These aren't like, it's just kind of a bit worker placementy here, and the fact that like the first person to go to these spaces is going to get the better reward, but it gives you a nice flow to the game where you're not always moving around the map. There's points where you kind of have a turn where the other player is really jumping for those good reinforcement spaces and taking a turn to just bolster up their troops and maybe get themselves some cards.
Yeah.
Cards, you don't have that many of them in the game. They pop up here and there, but they kind of just add an uneasiness to the game in the fact that you have a sense of what you're likely to be able to achieve, but then never 100%, because as I say, the combat is very dice-based and is a case of like, well, if I can get my unit to this space, then I can attack those boats with three dice, which feels like it's going to be really good, but you still might roll really badly, right? You know, And what's nice about these little symbols on the board and the way that they give you different actions in different spaces is that it creates a sense of geography that it doesn't need art to have. You can kind of see it in your head where you're like, okay, well, from this space, units can attack other things, but from this space, units can shell like ships, and the ships can't attack them from the space next to them. And you go, yeah, there's kind of a cliff edge there. So you can kind of imagine like the dudes kind of going over the edge of the cliff and like shooting down at boats in a way that the boat's struggling to hit them back. And it's just nice the way you then have this like quite 3D sense of a little space, which isn't really supported by anything other than very gentle stylistic artwork and rules, which is really quite neat. On the bigger map, I must say I much preferred the bigger map version of the game because it had a bit more of a sense of like momentum. The small map is a bit of a skirmish, where the other one, you have more space between players at the start. It's much more of a kind of moving out to take over areas, building up forces, the siege weaponry and moving that around and getting it into place. It just felt a little bit juicier and felt a little bit more like you were playing a war game. And even though the mechanics of it aren't the same at all, I can't really put my finger on why, but the whole thing reminded me a lot of Advance Wars, the old games of the Game Boy Advance, and it kind of had that like delightful simplicity and chunkiness. I really enjoyed playing it. I think that actually, like, my one criticism of the game, which is, it's wild to say this because we never say this, but I think it might be too small. you know, I'm usually, which is proof, you know, because we're always saying, well, it's too big. But this is actually too small, I think, because not only is it just slightly fiddly because you're dealing with a very small map and very small components, it's very dependent on you being able to see the things on the hexes because there are lots of these specific symbols around the edge of it. And as soon as you start moving units into the spaces, even though they stack up, little chips that stack up on top of each other, as soon as you start doing that and placing your little poles, your little tall circles on those spaces, it becomes a little bit harder to read the board. And obviously, it's a head-to-head war game, so you don't want to be too obviously, like, you know, being like, can I have a look under that? Can I have a look at that? And it's just something that I feel like would be easily fixed with just a little more breathing room, the board just being a little bit bigger.
And I imagine that's also sort of an accessibility concern as well with these... arguably very, very important icons potentially being too small to realistically see or obscured by a sort of taller, jaggedy piece, which looks lovely, like the photography on this game, like the actual like images I'm looking at right here. Ooh, it looks sharp, but also sharp, I need to see it next to a human hand.
Yeah, and also I think it suffers from that... what's the name? What's the blue and white game?
Lisboa.
Yeah, Lisboa. Lisboa. Got it in one. It suffers from the Lisboa complex a little bit, and the fact that because it has this very like stylistic graphic design on the board, which looks awesome, it does mean that like it's a bit less readable. And it's not like pure Lisboa, which I found just actually gave me a headache because I had to do all of the thinking whilst looking at a blue and white diagram. But it definitely has things where you sometimes didn't notice stuff or found it, you know, it wasn't immediately obvious where things were, even where the map was empty. You're like, where's that space? And, you know, it's not a huge deal because you are just playing on these two maps and you only have to play them like once to be like, I know what the spaces are. But again, it's just something where if the board was just maybe a third bigger and just had a little bit more breathing room, it wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see these two designers that we've, you know, we loved their work for like ages, continuing to work on these like quite thematic little small box experiences. Like Undaunted still keeps it down to like a pretty svelte box, and this is, you know, taking that philosophy even further, making it ever smaller, but still staying quite thematic, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the fact that this was a little head-to-head war game depicting a different era of war. And, you know, I've grown a little tired of the classic formula of white dudes making games about geishas and samurais, if I'm honest. But this, like, feels like an interesting little, like, snapshot of a conflict in the way that it feels earned and it feels different and it feels just evocative of a different space. And I think that's especially helped by the fact that you don't have this sort of, like, big book of of different maps, etc. It is just these two different conflicts on these two boards. Really enjoyable. I mean, honestly, it's like, they're mechanically a lot of fun, and it's just lovely to see something like this that isn't just another World War II game, because we've got lots of them.
There's there's a few of those. So that was General Orders, Sengoku Jidai, and that is the end of this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about Tag Team, Suna Valo, and General Orders, Sengoku Jidai. And we will continue to talk about more games on more podcasts.
More podcasts, more games.
Into the future.
Yeah. Who knew?
Who knew? Thank you so much for listening, everyone. We'll see you again very soon.
Goodbye.